also greet you in Jesus' name this morning. I've also been blessed in being here. That last song that we sang, the phrase that just really spoke to me was, "Once again, we come needy." I feel that way this morning as I stand here before you. I sense needs in my own heart, my own life, and thankful again for what God has done. We again stand here at the end of another year, and a lot of times as we just reflect back on the past year, we do some evaluation. I think it's good for us just to think, how have we done? How have we done? Have we grown in our spiritual lives? Have we developed into more and more godliness in our lives? We look at the habits of our lives, whether they're good habits or bad habits. It's a good time for us just to reflect and to see if there's areas that we need to take action in. My message this morning is not necessarily one of reflection, but I suppose it could lend itself to that, and I hope by the end of the sermon that we'll do some reflecting and do some thinking, looking back in our lives. This sermon was probably inspired by a couple things. One was a conversation that we had in our family devotions here some time ago, and probably the other thing was just the reflection I've done in my own life over the last couple years. I'd like to just simply speak about how we as humans tend to react to things in our lives. And I didn't know what title to give this, and so I finally just wrote down reactionary or living like Jesus. I know that's probably not a real good title, but that's kind of the gist of what I would like to look at this morning. And I suppose I should put in a little bit of a disclaimer here as well. I'm not some kind of person that understands a lot about how we react to things and how we process things and think things. I don't pretend to know and understand all the things that come to bear on us. But as I was pondering how to begin here this morning, my mind went to Newton's third law of motion. Can anyone tell me what that is? Newton's third law of motion. Well, that, I'm not sure which one that is, but it's not the one that I was looking at. The third law, Newton's third law of motion, says that for every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction. And I was thinking about that as I was looking at this subject. Forces, every force, forces always occur in pairs, and they're equal to each other and opposite to each other. In other words, I can put my hand on here, and whatever force I push down on it, it's pushing back with an equal amount of force. When you throw a ball, the force that you exert toward that ball, it's also pushing back on you with an equal amount of force as well. When you have a rocket and it begins to expel those gases out the bottom of that rocket, it exerts a force that propels that rocket the opposite direction. That third law of motion is what allows us to walk, because when your foot is on the ground and you're pushing against the ground, it is pushing against you with an equal and opposite reaction. Just a few examples of what we're talking about here, and I would like to propose this morning that there's something similar that can happen to us as we go through life. We see something or we experience something and we react to that. And a lot of times it's in the opposite direction from whatever that may be. And as we look around us, as we see people around us, we see situations around us, and I will tell you this morning, as I studied and pondered this, I see a lot of this in myself. And I don't think there's any one of us here that is exempt from this, but I really saw it in myself as I looked at this. You know, we can see situations where people have reacted to things in their past or in their life, to situations or to people, and they end up, like we say, way out in left field. You can see someone who was brought up maybe in a very strict church setting. And they see the shortcomings of that setting. And so they begin to say that what's in the heart, that's the only thing that matters. Rules can't produce godliness. And so we react to that and we go out the opposite direction. Or maybe it's the other extreme, where someone has been brought up in a very relaxed church setting. And there's no emphasis on standards and guidelines and so on. And that person sees the shortcomings in that particular setting, and so they react and they say, well, we need rules. It can also be in our homes, where you have someone that reacts to the way that their parents have brought them up, and they react to that, and they want freedom, and they basically go out into the world. And it's just a lot of it is a reaction to how they've been brought up. And I suppose, and we could go on and on giving a lot of examples, and I suppose in all of these examples, there are shortcomings, there are failures, whether it's in our parents, whether it's in us, whether it's in church leaders, whatever it may be, that we can react to and that we can use that as justification for just reacting and going off in another direction. And so this morning, I'd just like to look at a few. First of all, I'd like to look at a few examples. Turn with me to 1 Samuel chapter 18. I'd like to look at two examples of people who reacted. And the first example that I have here is the example of Saul. Let's read 1 Samuel 18, just verses 6 through 9. And it came to pass, as they came, this is talking about when David was returned. It came to pass when David was returned from the slaughter of the Philistine, that the women came out of all cities of Israel, singing and dancing, to meet King Saul with tabrets and joy, with joy and with instruments of music. And the women answered one another as they played and said, Saul has slain his thousands and David his 10,000s. And Saul was very wroth, and the saying displeased him. And he said, they have ascribed unto David 10,000s, and to me they have ascribed but thousands. And what can he have more but the kingdom? And Saul eyed David from that day and forward. And we could continue reading there of what all happened there. But when Saul perceived that the women were honoring David above him, he became very jealous and very upset about that. And one of the things that you see in Saul's life here was that he simply could not see clearly because of his reaction to this. He very strongly reacted. And that's one of the results of when we react to situations. It's hard for us to see clearly. And I see that in Saul here. We can only see what we want to see. And we know from the scriptures that David had no designs whatsoever on Saul's kingdom. He had multiple opportunities to kill Saul. And Saul even knew of those opportunities, that David did not take that opportunity to do so. But Saul was convinced, and I believe it's because of his reaction here to what the women were singing. Saul was convinced against all the available evidence that David would try to take the kingdom from him. And his vision was clouded by the jealousy that he experienced toward David. And he put all kinds of effort into trying to destroy David. He tried to kill David himself. He instructed his sons and his servants that they were to kill David. He chased David all over the land of Israel. And as I look at this, I think if Saul could only have seen beyond himself. But yet I believe it was that reaction that he had here that kept him from being able to see the real situation. And you know, you and I face the same struggle in life. When we react to something, it keeps us from being able, like I said, to see clearly. And we become blinded to what's really going on. We can be blinded to the good in our brother and our sister because we are reacting to something that we do not appreciate. And so just like Saul, we react to what we think we see. Let's look at one more example in chapter 25, 1 Samuel 25. Here we have David, beginning to read in verse 4. And David heard in the wilderness that Nabal did shear his sheep. And David sent out 10 young men. And David said unto the young men, Get you up to Carmel, and go to Nabal, and greet him in my name. And thus shall ye say to him that liveth in prosperity, Peace be both to thee, and peace be to thine house, and peace be unto all that thou hast. And now I have heard that thou hast shears. Now thy shepherds which were with us, we hurt them not. Neither was there aught missing unto them all the while they were in Carmel. Ask thy young men, and they will show thee. Wherefore let the young men find favor in thine eyes, for we come in a good day. Give, I pray thee, whatsoever cometh to thine hand, unto thy servants and to thy son David. And when David's young men came, they spake to Nabal according to all those words in the name of David, and ceased. And Nabal answered David's servants and said, Who is David? And who is the son of Jesse? There be many servants nowadays that break away every man from his master. Shall I then take my bread and my water and my flesh that I have killed for my shears and give it unto men whom I know not whence they be? So David's young men turned their way and went again and came and told him all those sayings. And David said unto his men, Gird ye on every man his sword. And they girded on every man his sword, and David also girded on his sword. And there went up after David about 400 men, and 200 abode by the stuff. We'll stop reading there. But again, we go on in the story, you know, how that one of Nabal's servants went and talked to Abigail and told her what was going to happen here. But one of the things that I see here is that when we react to something, reactions tend to overkill, or another word we use is overreactions. You know, when you're driving down the road and you get off the side of the road and you jerk yourself back, you tend to overcorrect, and you can go off the other side of the road. And I think that's what happened here with David. David had protected Nabal and his possessions. In fact, the servant here of Nabal had told Abigail in verse 16, he said, They were a wall unto us, both by night and day. So they protected Nabal and his possessions. And in all good faith, David had respected his property. David wasn't demanding anything. In verse 8, he just simply asked respectfully. He said, Give, I pray thee, whatsoever cometh to thine hand unto thy servants and to thy son David. He's very respectful. And if I'm thinking correctly here, this was a common response during a time like this when there was a festival or in this case, the sheep shearing and so on. To give to someone, and feast days were often when people in need were given. They would give something. But Nabal here was was a churlish man, it says. And that just simply means he was obstinate. He was stiff-necked. He was stubborn. One of the interesting things that I found here that I never realized before, in verse... Oh, let me see here. In verse... No, I can't see it. It says that he was of the house of Caleb. And for some reason, I can't lay my eyes on it right now. Verse 3. It says, But the man was churlish and evil in his doings, and he was of the house of Caleb. And I just always assumed that that meant that he was a descendant of Caleb here, the one that we talked about in our Sunday school lesson. But the interesting thing is that I guess that word also refers to a dog, and some translations say that Nabal was snappish as a dog. That's how it's translated. So he was not a pleasant man. He was not a good man. And David here was so angered by Nabal's response that he decided to kill Nabal and all his men there. And I would ask us this morning, what did the servants of Nabal do to deserve being destroyed, like David was planning to do here? And as far as I know, we don't read of anything that they did anything that was deserving of being killed. But as we read on down through this chapter here, Abigail comes to David, and she provided some much-needed perspective when she met David. If we go down to verse 30, Abigail here is speaking to David, and she says, And it shall come to pass when the Lord shall have done to my Lord according to all the good that he has spoken concerning thee, and shall have appointed thee ruler over Israel, that this shall be no grief unto thee, nor offense of heart unto my Lord, either that thou hast shed blood causeless, or that my Lord hath avenged himself. But when the Lord shall have dealt well with my Lord, then remember thine handmaid. So Abigail here simply tells him, you know, David, don't do this because you don't want this to be a grief to you. And that means, that word grief means a stumbling block. And you know, when I think what she was saying was, David, when you are anointed king, when you are crowned king, you don't want to have to look back at this and have this be a blot on your conscience. You don't want this to be to look back and deal with regrets later on and regret the hasty action that you took here. And you know, when we tend to react to things, often isn't that what happens? We look back and we have a lot of regrets. We have a lot of things that we wish we wouldn't have done or things that we wish we wouldn't have said. She also, Abigail often also says here that it would be no offense of heart. And it seems as though Abigail is pleading with David here to think of the consequences of what he was about to do. It would have been a blot on his conscience. Like I said, when he looked back, it would have been something that his conscience would bother him that he did it. And Abigail is here pleading with him to consider a clear conscience. And again, what I see in David here is, you know, as you look back at David's life, he had plenty of opportunities to react to the way Saul treated him. But yet somehow he never lost sight of the fact that Saul was God's anointed, and he refused to take Saul's life. But yet in this situation here, somehow it seems like David just simply reacted out of all proportion to what actually happened here. And that's often the way we do when we react. We overreact out of all proportion to the actual situation. You know, even though Nabal was incredibly rude here, yet he had done nothing, as far as I know, to warrant his life being snuffed out. He was incredibly rude. He was terribly, terribly rude to David's servants. But because of his rudeness and Nabal's response, David was outraged, and he was not, I don't believe that David was looking for justice. He was looking for revenge here. And isn't that often how it is when we react? We're looking for revenge. David wanted to inflict more pain and more suffering on Nabal than what he himself had experienced. If you go back into Leviticus chapter 19, God back there had told the Israelites, he had said, thou shalt not avenge nor bear any grudge against the children of thy people, but thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. That was in the Old Testament already. That they were not to avenge themselves or to bear a grudge. And you know, if David would have gone ahead with his plans here to kill all the men related to Nabal, him and his servants and his family, I really think David would have looked back later and wondered, why did I do that? I really think he would have. And sometimes that's how it is with us. As we look back, we wonder, why did I say what I did? And again, it was just because I reacted. And it bothers our conscience, and sometimes we need to go back and make things right. I would like to look now at just a few causes of reaction, or we could say overreacting. And I just have a number of things listed here. Most of them I don't have much to say about them, but I just want us to think about these. And number one, one of the main reasons we react to someone or to something is that we see the faults and the failures in people and situations, and we react to that. And as an example, I'd like for us to think a little bit about the hippie movement back in the 60s. Now, some of you would remember this. This was before my time. I was born in the 70s, so this was before I was even born. But I've read a lot about it, or some about it. The hippie movement was begun as a countercultural rebellion against mainstream American society. And it was primarily begun as a reaction to the emphases of American society following World War II. Following World War II, the United States was a booming place. And people were very caught up in consumerism, consuming things, materialism, conformity. You needed to conform to society's expectations if you were going to be accepted. The typical ideals of a family was that a woman would be at home. She would be a housewife at home. She would take care of the home. The man would have a steady job and provide for his family. And people were chasing the American dream. And if you wanted to be accepted as a member of society, you needed to be productive. That was very important. Material possessions became very important. And these young people just simply reacted to that. You know, for example, designer clothes became very important during this time. And so the hippies, in reaction to that, they refused to buy name brand clothes. And they would just go to the flea market or to the thrift store and they would buy their clothes there. It was a reaction to what was in general society. Most of these young people were from middle and upper class middle families. And they saw the weaknesses, they saw the failures of society. And they vowed that they were never going to be like that. But the end result really was just simply excesses in the opposite direction. Remember the opposite and equal reactions? That's what happened here. And they were radically different than general society. And so the reality is that all of us, I think this is probably true for all of us, no matter who we are, there are things, there are situations, there are people that you and I can react to. We see failures, we see weaknesses, and we can react to those things. And we can use that as justification for reaction. So we see the faults, we see the failures, and we react to that. Number two, many times people react because they're trying to prove something. And this can come into play in a lot of different ways. Maybe it's we want to prove that we're better than someone. Maybe we want to prove that we're worth something. And so we react and we go down that road. Number three, reaction can come through emotional hurts. And emotional hurts can come through various ways. We as parents can oftentimes inflict that on our children without even realizing it. Or maybe it's through friends. And one of the easiest things that you and I can do when we experience emotional hurts is that we just simply react. And we're determined that we will not be like them. Number four, we react because we're trying to be good enough. Maybe we keenly feel our inability to be good enough, or we feel that way, and so we react. We take our eyes off of Jesus and we begin focusing on that other person. In many ways we try to be good enough. Maybe it's by doing everything just right. Maybe it's by spiritual disciplines or performing well in life. There's all kinds of ways that we can try to do that. But we can, if we're not careful, we can react. Number five, we try to feed our self-esteem. I believe this morning when we react to someone or to people or to situations, a lot of times the focus is right here. It's on me. And it's easy for me to gain a superior feeling towards someone or something because, you know, I'm not going to be like them. And we can pride ourselves in that. And maybe we don't always recognize that. What is the common denominator on all these things that I just mentioned as reasons for reactions? Well, a lot of times I think we react because we're focusing more on what we do not want to be than what we should be. And I believe this morning that if we're going to overcome in our Christian life, it is not based on how well we are not being like someone or something. When we become consumed by making sure we are not like someone has said that that's just as bad as being like that person. That we're trying so hard not to be like. We talked about Newton's third law of motion, that equal and opposite reaction. The same is true of people. When we react so often, we move in the opposite directions and we end up in positions that are no more biblical than the one that we're reacting to. And we can become very unbalanced. So what is the answer? What is the answer to this? Because as I thought about this and looked at it, I began to wonder, is there any way that we can escape from this reactionary tendency that we all have? Is that even possible? And I'm not going to answer that necessarily, but I believe one of the keys we find in Hebrews chapter 12. If you would turn there with me, just a couple verses. Hebrews chapter 12, verses 1 and 2. Familiar verses to us. Wherefore, seeing we also are compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which doth so easily beset us, and let us run with patience the race that is set before us. And I believe in the beginning of verse 2 is one of the keys, looking unto Jesus. That, you know, in our devotional this morning, we heard about Jesus being the central reason why we are here. Jesus being the central reason why we live our lives the way we do. Looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is set down at the right hand of the throne of God. I believe the key to living is not in reaction, but in response to our Savior. Looking unto Jesus, looking away from the world, whatever takes our eyes from him, looking away from the people and the situations that may cause us to react. Think this morning if we could somehow fix that in our minds. And I wonder sometimes if the reason it's so hard to fix that in our minds is because we're right here with each other. And we have to deal with each other and interact with each other. We have close connections. Looking unto Jesus, we see him with the eye of faith. And so the next thought that came to me was, what, you know, looking unto Jesus, what does that mean? Well, how did Jesus walk? How did Jesus do? And I just have a couple things down here, and I'm sure there's many, many more that you could develop this into, but the first point I have is Jesus spoke truth to people. You know, when Jesus came, he had to deal with this group of people called the Pharisees. And I'll tell you, they were some of the hardest people to deal with. They were some of the hardest people to relate to. They had their religious systems in place, and they were very concerned about speaking truth to people. And if I understand right, the Pharisees were established as a way to bring truth back to the people, to worship God correctly and in the right way. That's what they were concerned about. But they had very little compassion for people. They were very concerned about restoring the true worship, and that is why they had so many traditions and rules and things that you had to follow. That became their overriding goal, was to get it right. And Jesus could have reacted to that and said, no, 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 let's just show compassion to people. But he didn't do that. He still spoke truth. He spoke hard truths to anyone. Not indiscriminately, not without love, but he spoke hard things sometimes. You know, he called them generations of vipers, whited sepulchres, and more. And you and I are called to speak the truth as well. If we go back to Ephesians chapter 4, just a couple verses here. Ephesians 4 verse 15 says, "But speaking the truth in love may grow up into him in all things, which is the head, even Christ." And if we go down to verse 25, he says, "Wherefore, putting away lying, speak every man truth with his neighbor, for we are members one of another." Speaking the truth in love is one of the ways in which you and I mature into godly people. It's one of the ways that we mature in Christ. And you know, that can be hard to do if we've grown up in a setting or if we've experienced truth without love. We tend to react to that and we say, well, we just need love. And we see the shortcomings of that kind of an approach. And we don't want to hurt that person. We don't want to say anything that causes pain. And so we can tend to react and just leave truth out of it, at least somewhat. The second thing that Jesus did was he showed compassion to those who needed that. And as I thought about this, I just was looking through the Bible. God is described throughout the Scriptures as a God of compassion. Psalm 78, verse 38, "But he, being full of compassion, forgave their iniquity and destroyed them not. Yea, many a time turned he his anger away and did not stir up all his wrath." Psalm 86, verse 15, "But thou, O Lord, art a God full of compassion and gracious, long-suffering and plenteous in mercy and truth." Psalm 112, verse 4, "Unto the upright there ariseth light in the darkness. He is gracious and full of compassion and righteousness." And there's many, many more. Lamentation, chapter 3, verse 22, said, "It is of the Lord's mercies that we are not consumed, because he is full of compassion." And over throughout the Gospels, we read of Jesus, it says that he was moved with compassion. I think of the man who lay beside the pool of Siloam for 38 years. And Jesus came and he had compassion on him and he healed him. There are many who need compassion. And you know, sometimes my personal tendency is that when someone really messes up, I don't want to show them any compassion because they should have known better. And maybe they should have. But Hebrews chapter 5 and verse 2 says, "For every high priest taken from among men is ordained for men in things pertaining to God, that he may offer both gifts and sacrifices for sins, who can have compassion on the ignorant and on them that are out of the way, for that he himself also is compassed with infirmity." And you know, this morning, our own weaknesses, our own tendency to react, if I may say it that way, should cause us to have compassion on those who maybe have reacted. And we can see that and we say, oh, you know, that's not good. But it ought to cause us to have compassion. We're called to have that same compassion for one another. Number three, Jesus laid down his life. And when we think of Jesus laying down his life, our mind goes right away to the end of his life where he gave his life for us, gave his life for our redemption. It causes our hearts to swell in gratitude for that. But I believe this morning that Jesus was laying down his life long before that. We go back into Mark chapter 6. Jesus told his disciples, he said, "Come ye apart, we need to rest for a while." And it says, "For there were many coming and going, they had no leisure so much as to eat." They didn't even have time to eat. You find that several times in the book of Mark. And you see this pattern as Jesus followed throughout his life on earth. He served and he ministered and he met the needs of people. Different times the Gospels tell us that people thronged him. There were times when Jesus simply couldn't go places because it says that people blazed abroad what he did and he couldn't even go there because the people wouldn't let him go. In John chapter 10, verse 17 and 18, it says, "Therefore doth my Father love me, because I lay down my life, that I might take it again. No man taketh it from me, but I lay it down of myself. I have power to lay it down, and I have power to take it again." And so Jesus voluntarily laid down his life. He said, "I lay down my life." And yes, he did that in redeeming each one of us, but he did that while he was living and ministering and working with people. And so as I pondered that, it's just the question came to me, am I willing to lay down my life in that same way for each one of you? Are you willing to lay down your life for each other? Even when it's not appreciated. You know, Jesus laid down his life many times and it was not appreciated. There were those who rejected him. But am I willing to give my time and my energy to help my brother when he needs help? Are you willing to help that sister when she is struggling? You know, it's easy to say that you and I could, we'd be willing to lay down our lives, to give our lives for each other. But what about just the small, daily, everyday things of life? Are we willing to lay down our lives in that way? And you know, sometimes we can react to maybe experiences we've had, but am I willing to lay down my life even in those situations? And so as we conclude here, as we reflect, as you reflect over your life in the past year, have you reacted to life or have you lived like Jesus? Paul in Philippians chapter 3, verse 10 says that I may know him. Paul said, I want to know Jesus Christ. And I don't know what all that entails. I think it probably means a lot more than I even realize. That I may know him. That I may know Jesus. Yes, we're human. And sometimes it's hard for us to respond like Jesus did because we deal with our humanity. We're in the flesh. Sometimes we fail, and you know, when we do that, we get up and we try again. But if we are to know Jesus, our life will not be a reactionary life, but it will be one that seeks to conform to his life. Not a life that where we're trying to be like someone or try not to be like someone, but it will be one that tries to be like Christ, one that conforms to his image. Success is not based on how well we are not like someone, but by how well we portray Christ.